Hello and welcome to the Mijlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pinier, host of the Mijlis and author of the Central Asia in Focus newsletter. It's been 2 years since authorities in Uzbekistan responded with force to peaceful protests in the Qarakalpak Sovereign Republic. The reason for the protests was proposed changes to Uzbekistan's constitution that would have negatively changed the situation for Qarakalpakstan, which is technically part of Uzbekistan. Officially, 21 people were killed during the unrest in Qarakalpakstan's capital, Nukus, but some accounts put the figure at several times higher. One thing is sure, nearly everyone punished for the violence was a Qarakalpak protester. Uzbek authorities continue to try to eliminate any signs of discontent among Qarakalpaks, even Qarakalpaks outside Uzbekistan who have been offering alternative narratives about what happened at the start of July 2022. It's become difficult for Qarakalpaks to find a safe haven in any country. To discuss this situation in and around Qarakalpakstan in the last 2 years, I am joined by Hugh Williamson, the director of the Europe and Central Asia Division at Human Rights Watch, and Minyam, Qarakalpak activist now living outside Uzbekistan. And I will note that Minyam is a pseudonym we are using to protect her and her family and friends still in Qarakalpakstan. We are also going to be using a different voice for Minyam. And hopefully we will be joined soon by Laila Nazgul Saitbek, a lawyer and chairwoman of the NGO Freedom for Eurasia. Thank you all for joining me. Hugh, I'd like to start with you. Can you set the table for us? Take us back 2 years and tell us what happened in July and leading up to July 2022.
Bruce, thank you so much for having me on the program. It's nice to be here. Those were awful events back in the first couple of days of July 2022 in Qarakalpakstan. As you said, the build-up was really concern on the streets of Qarakalpakstan, in Nukus and elsewhere, about the new constitution. There was a draft constitution tabled by the government of President Mirziyoyev in Tashkent. And when people started reading it, they recognized that it was going to change the rights of those in Qarakalpakstan in a negative way. So there was feeling of disquiet, unrest about that, and they wanted to, in a sense, express that, and there were some calls for peaceful protests, and that's what started in the last days of June 2022. And those came to a head on the 1st and the 2nd of July 2022, when there were quite sizable numbers of people protesting, both in Nukus and a few other places around Qarakalpakstan. Yeah, and as you said, the protests consist of gatherings in various parts of Nukus and then moving around the city and so on, protesting peacefully, largely peacefully is the way Human Rights Watch has defined the protest. So overwhelmingly peaceful, giving absolutely no reason for the military, for the police to intervene in the way they did. So that's the context in a sense of what happened. And on the days of the 1st and the 2nd of July, there was essentially a brutal intervention by security services, which killed at least 21 people, including four law enforcement officers, and injuring at least 270. We really don't know how many were killed. Human Rights Watch was not able to verify the 21 or indeed more. But it's quite possible that more were killed. There were very few independent witnesses to the scene. Journalists and others were only allowed in a few days later. So it's very difficult to verify that. I'll talk a little bit about our research, because we tried very hard to research remotely what happened on those 2 days. We did this by doing investigative analysis of over 100 videos and photos of the events on those 2 days. So very thorough analysis of those videos and photos. And those were all photos and videos of the protests themselves and how the security forces reacted to them. Some very gruesome photos of the injuries and some of the photos of the dead, who were killed as well. And we were really trying to establish why the security forces opened fire in the way they did, and there was clashes with the protesters, whether they were provoked or not, whether there was any justification at all for what they did. Because from a human rights framework, we have to look at the context for a conflict in order to establish whether there were severe human rights abuses or not. And we really established that there was significant abuses committed by the security forces involved. And I'll tell you a little bit about what those involved from our analysis, from what we've seen from the videos and the photos. We're very sure in our findings that we published later in year 2022 that the police misused the equipment they had to try to put the protest down. They inappropriately used grenades of various sorts. They had some ammunition, and they were mostly, you know, grenades, stun grenades, mostly quite small grenades. And the security forces simply threw or used devices to throw these grenades at the protesters. And they often did that from rather short range. And they did that in a way which hit the protesters directly. And these weapons are not meant to be used in this way. And that either killed protesters or caused them such extremely serious injuries that they were maimed for the rest of their lives. So there's the misuse of stun grenades. They also misused even larger grenades that they threw into the crowd that hit protesters or landed very near them and caused significant injury or death. That was the main cause of the 17 protesters who were definitely killed at that time. We also have evidence in one case that there was a use of live ammunition in a gun, so shooting into the crowd, and that person was killed. So those are very serious abuses, and we'll get on to the lack of investigation. It's absolutely necessary for the Uzbek authorities to investigate why their security forces acted in this way and misused this equipment and led to the deaths of so many people. So that's what happened. And then a few days later, they allowed some reporters in who managed to gather some testimony and so on. Since then, as you hinted at in your introduction, Bruce, there's been a sort of a climate of fear has been created around Karakalpakstan Pakistan in the region and also elsewhere. Immediately afterwards, the government did two things. Formally, they set up an investigation. A commission was established. They were very proud of that, by the way. You know, they called up Human Rights Watch. They called up all other organizations to tell us they were launching a commission to investigate what happened. This was headed by the ombudswoman, the human rights ombudswoman in Tashkent. Many other people were involved, including some civil society people who did their best on the commission to try to find evidence, and we met them. At the same time, they started harassing and arresting protesters. They started identifying who was involved in the protests, and they rounded them up and they arrested them. Some of them were tortured, and they held them in detention for a long time. And a large number was a month later in November, December 22, and in early 23, there were two major trials held. And we can maybe talk about that later. But so those arrests led to significant trials, which were effectively sort of show trials, really. Here were the people who organized these awful protests, the government was saying, and here are the guilty parties. Yeah? And that was their message to the international community. They were also, you know, proud in a sense of these trials, and they wanted people to come and observe these trials. Human Rights Watch found that the fair processes were not observed in these trials, but we can perhaps talk about that later. And indeed, as we'll talk about, there were started harassing Karakalpak activists and others who were not activists, but simply people who were sharing information who were living abroad, Kazakhstan and elsewhere. And they've been harassed and arrested by Kazakhstan under the request from Uzbekistan and so on. Finally, in terms of this context setting, we should know that this commission that was set up just days after the protests never delivered a report. They were always said we were going to deliver it soon. There was a lot of anticipation what would be in this report, but it never happened. And now the government sort of has buried this idea that they're going to publish a report. So there's never been an effective investigation. Of course, Human Rights Watch and other groups also asked for international investigators to be allowed to come into the country. We were pleased this the government set up their own commission, but we were, skeptical about its independence from the government. And we wanted international experts from the UN or the OSCE to come. That was also denied. They would not allow that because they had their own investigation, which never delivered. And their own prosecution service has never really investigated. We should note that three police have been prosecuted for illegal action during the time, including torture. But it's a very small number, an extremely small number compared to the scale of the violence and the dozens and dozens of who were arrested and harassed and tortured after the protests. So that's a bit of a context setting, Bruce.
No, great. Thank you. Thank you. That was very important. Minaim, let me ask you a question. Dawlat Murat Tajimuratov, he's going to be a central figure in all this. Can you tell us who Dawlat Tajimuratov is?
Dawlat Murat Tajimuratov is undoubtedly a Karakalpak national hero. Through his founding of the newspaper El Hizmeti, he fearlessly tackled the issues plaguing Karakalpakstan, shedding light on corruption and injustices. His dual role as a journalist and an esteemed lawyer allowed him to advocate for justice, offering his legal expertise pro bono to those in need. Beyond his journalistic and legal endeavors, Tajimuratov's impact resonates deeply through his extensive civil work. His spread-headed projects to provide remote regions with vital resources like water and infrastructure such as roads, significantly improving their quality of life. His dedication to serving the community earned him widespread admiration and love. Dawlat Murat Tajimuratov embodies the courage, integrity, and selflessness that define a national hero, earning him rightful recognition and reverence among the people of Karakalpakstan.
Let me follow up with that. On the day that the violence broke out, he actually went to the authorities, the administration building in Nukus, and asked permission to hold a peaceful demonstration. Is that true?
Yes, you are absolutely right. Dawlat Murat Tajimuratov requested permission to hold a peaceful protest from government officials. However, his request was met with hostility. Later that day, law enforcement officers stormed his home, violently assaulted him in front of his family, and detained him.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Lila, hello, how are you? Why don't you take us through the, you know, Hugh was just talking about the trial process a little bit, but tell us, there was two different trials. And who was on trial and what were the verdicts?
Hello, thank you for inviting me to talk about this Karakalpak events. And there were two trials in Uzbekistan held against the people that were arrested during the protests and afterwards. And we have also published several analyses of these trials. There was, for example, a trial against 16 Karakalpak people, and they were charged with extremist crimes. Most of the people that were on trial were actually charged with extremist articles and have received very lengthy prison sentences. And there was a group of 39 people, I believe, and another group of 22 people. And among those on trial were lawyers and journalists who actually have not committed any acts of violence, but were simply either participating in, you know, discourse about the constitutional changes that was before the protest broke out. And many of them were colleagues and friends of Dawlat Murat Tajimuratov. I also want to talk a little about this committee that was created that Hugh has mentioned. It's interesting that when we held a side event at the ODIHR in Warsaw last October, there was a delegation from Uzbekistan present at this side event, and unfortunately, they seemed to be not ready to speak about the events. And they have denied, obviously, any wrongdoing by the forces. And what they have also told us that they have created this committee to investigate the protest and investigate the claims that, you know, many people were injured and killed and disappeared. But unfortunately, up to the present moment, we haven't seen any report by that committee. And from Freedom for Eurasia, we have sent several letters to the ombudswoman and asked her whether or not the committee has produced any sort of a report. And unfortunately, we have not received any response. Also, they have somehow argued that they are not publishing this report because the trials were still ongoing. But now the trials are now over and we still don't see a report from them. There were also very disturbing reports about the detained people being tortured. And some of the people, some of the opinion makers in the Karakalpak community in Nukus, for example, you know, the people that are respected by others and have sort of like a very authoritative standing in their communities, they have been taken to interrogation after the protest and they were returned dead to their families. And many of them carried signs of really horrible torture. And these cases have not been investigated properly by Uzbekistan. Obviously, we all had very limited access to Nukus. We tried to send a mission to interview some of the families of the victims. And we sent the missions twice to Uzbekistan. Unfortunately, one of the missions resulted in our experts being banned from Uzbekistan. And for several months, we tried to argue with that decision and find out the grounds for this ban, because they obviously did not violate any Uzbek laws to be banned. And the final answer that we have received from SNB was that they are not obliged to provide any explanation, basically. So that's basically the news from my side.
Bruce, I can come in and add a tiny bit more about the trials. I think that's really important to make that point. Should I do so?
Please, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about the important role of Dalet Murat Tajimuratov, the journalist and community leader, in a sense, who convened some of the non-violent protests at the time in early July. He was on trial in Bukhara, and a trial which ended in late January 23. That's one of the trials that Leila was talking about, where in this case there were 22 defendants. He was sentenced to 16 years. We should really hang on to that. He convened, he called for peaceful protests, and he was given a 16-year prison sentence in that trial. In that trial also, 15 other people were sentenced to between 3 and 8.5 years in prison. Also, as far as we could establish for just being part of police of peaceful protests. So, you know, we should hold these sort of very lengthy prison sentences in mind as we think about the responsibility of the Uzbek government to investigate this. And just a couple of points about our concerns about the trials. It's very difficult to establish how they were done, really. We were not there. But a couple of points. I mean, we did look at what evidence there was available about Tajimuratov, and we could not establish anything that would comply with the extremism charges, which Leila mentioned, that would justify such a long sentence. So from our analysis, it's very difficult to believe that he could convincingly be convicted on those charges. And secondly, of course, he made allegations that were made public that he was tortured between July and the end of the year. And we're obviously worried that those investigations were not, that torture was not investigated in the trial. Huh? Those allegations were not investigated. It's very important in such a trial to investigate, to look at the conditions under which the prisoners were being held. And then in link to that, then, you know, was the evidence tainted, you know, by torture? Was he forced to make confessions or say things because he'd been tortured in the investigation that then those transcripts were then used in court later? That's quite possible. That happens in Uzbekistan, you know, and there's another question mark over the legitimacy of the trial.
I would like to intervene and talk about the trial of three police officers involved in the violent suppression of peaceful protesters. The Uzbek government did not disclose their names, and the trial was not open to the public. I fear that those officers are ethnically Karakalpak, might be scapegoats, and may have actually opposed the violence. One of the arrested individuals, Palat Shamshetov, formerly employed by the Ministry of Internal Affairs, was detained because he opposed the use of heavy military force against peaceful protesters. His trial was conducted behind closed doors. I do not trust the Uzbek government to hold these three police officers accountable. They should have conducted a transparent trial, made the proceeding public, and at the very least disclosed the names of those involved so that accountability and justice could be properly assessed.
No, this is a good point. And we, you know, since you brought up the Polat Shamshetov, it's worth mentioning he died just days after he was sent to prison, right?
Yes, and he was healthy. I was in touch with his family. He did not have any health issues. It was obvious that he was murdered by Uzbek police in detention.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, just wanted to add some more detail on the trials. So, in the case of 22 participants in the 2022 protest, there are still seven people from this group that are held in Uzbek penitentiary institutions, and they are sentenced to 5, 6, 8 years in prison for. Also, we don't know if there was hard evidence of them committing any crimes other than just, a wish to participate in a peaceful protest. And in the case of 39 participants of the peaceful protest, in the trial that took place in Bukhara in 2023, 28 people were sentenced to various terms of imprisonment, and then 11 of them were sentenced to non-custodial punishment. So at present, there are 23 of them that are still in prison, and they have also a wide-ranging, long prison sentences ranging from 7 to 11 years, and some received 10 years. Yeah. So, and most of them are charged with extremist crimes.
Okay. Thank you. Before we leave this topic of the trials, because I think it's also important. I mean, we've mentioned that everyone that was sentenced so far was a Karakalpak and among the protesters. But in the immediate aftermath of the violence, and I should clarify that the constitutional amendments that were especially objectionable to the Karakalpak people were that they were going to lose their sovereignty. I mean, it is the Karakalpak Sovereign Republic. They were going to lose the sovereign part of that title. And also in both the Uzbek Constitution and Karakalpak Constitution, there's an article that says they have the right to call for a referendum to vote on secession from Uzbekistan. So in the immediate aftermath of the violence, President Mirziyoyev blamed people that were on the commission doing the amendments. He said, and blamed officials in Karakalpakstan. And why didn't you tell me it was going to be objectionable and it would provoke this kind of response if we were going to put these amendments into the Constitution? Has anyone, since Mirziyoyev clearly blamed the officials, has any official ever been charged with anything or even faced serious, some kind of consequences for that, as far as you know? Hugh?
I don't know actually whether they've faced consequences for that. So, but I mean, we have to note also the context that the proposed amendments were withdrawn by the Mirziyoyev government, weren't they? So, I mean, he withdrew them, but blamed local officials. Perhaps other colleagues know.
I just wanted to share some opinion about this. I think it's really a really well known tactic in our part of the world, in the former Soviet Union, where the Tsar is never one to blame. It's always the bad boyare, basically, the people who are surrounding him are to blame. But in reality, in a country like Uzbekistan is quite clear that trying to say, Mirziyoyev's attempt to say that he didn't know about this looks really strange. And I don't think it's plausible that he didn't know about it.
Yes, I completely agree. The Karakalpak government was instructed by Tashkent to prepare this documentation. And the initiative did not originate from the Karakalpak parliament. During the trial, Davlet Murat mentioned that he spoke to a parliament member who explained why she supported the constitutional amendment. She revealed that during the parliament session, there were two buttons only, agree and disagree. When she pressed the disagree button, it didn't register. There was effectively only one option. In essence, the process was orchestrated from Tashkent, and the Karakalpak local government merely took the blame.
Okay, thank you. These are important points to make clear for everybody. A reminder, we're talking about the dire situation of Karakalpaks, both inside and outside Karakalpakstan, and my guests are Leyla Nazgul Saitbek, a lawyer and chairwoman of the NGO Freedom for Eurasia, Hugh Williamson, the director of the Europe and Central Asia Division with Human Rights Watch, Mian Minaim, a Karakalpak activist now living outside Uzbekistan, and I will note that Minaim is a pseudonym we're using to protect her and her family and friends still in Karakalpakstan. We're also using a different voice for Minaim. Okay, let's try to bring it up a little bit closer to the future, but we have to deal a little bit with 2023 and what happened. Now, already by the end of 2022, there's Karakalpak activists in Kazakhstan, neighboring Kazakhstan, who are being detained. Leyla, I'll start with you. Can you bring us through what happened? There was five different Karakalpak activists that were detained in Kazakhstan. What happened to them?
Yeah, so the five activists that were posting some comments and posts on social media, and they were not really that widely known before their detention, but there was, you know, one of them was a cardiologist, the other one was a member of diaspora and worked as a cook in a cafe. So these are very normal people, really. And they were detained at the request of Uzbekistan by Kazakhstan. There was an extradition request. And Kazakhstan did not deny the extradition, as far as I remember, but they also did not extradite them. They denied their asylum applications, though. So Kazakhstan did not grant them asylum. But Kazakhstan did not extradite them to Uzbekistan, which is, I think, is a very smart move on the part of Kazakhstan to demonstrate to the international community that it's still, you know, somewhat fulfilling its international obligations. So it is unclear what their future is going to look like. Because, of course, remaining in Kazakhstan for them is not safe. They will always be attacked and threatened there because they're so easy to get to in Kazakhstan. And many of them have actually reported being approached by Uzbek officials. And there was even one of them, unfortunately, nearby. He was so scared by what was happening to him, and he was one of the leaders of Karakalpak diaspora in Kazakhstan. He was so worried about his situation that he actually had a heart attack and unfortunately died. And that actually happened after he was his Kazakh citizenship was revoked somehow because the Uzbek consulate has sent a paper to the Kazakh authorities. And they've been under tremendous pressure. And one of them now remains in custody. Actually, not one. I think there are three of them now because two more were arrested. So there is one of the famous ones is Zakalbek Muratbai. He is one of the vocal voices of Karakalpak people outside of Karakalpakstan. He remains behind bars right now. I think maybe Hugh can add some more details about their situation.
Okay, Hugh, can you tell us about there are three Karakalpaks who are in detention, currently in detention. They are different than the five Karakalpaks who were detained and let go. But what can you tell us about the three that were detained?
Yeah, I can tell you more information about Akolbek Muratov, who goes by Murat Bay. He was detained in mid-February this year and is still in detention. It's unclear what's going to happen to him. He was a little different to the other five, in that he had a relatively prominent profile internationally and in the English-speaking media in explaining and communicating about what was happening in Karakalpakstan back there, where he came from, where he comes from, communicating in an effective way. And we fear or suspect that could be one of the reasons why he was detained. It's possible he'll be detained for a year, like the other five were detained, and then released. It's a bit unclear, but obviously we're very concerned for him that he is being detained, and we're calling for his release. So that's what I know about that one. Not so much about the other two cases. I mean, I can draw attention to a new small report we've published on the 2nd of July. On the 1st of July, regarding the two-year anniversary, where we draw attention to some other relevant cases of people who've been rounded up or imprisoned back in Uzbekistan in connection with the Karakalpakstan protests. And also, we should remember that Uzbekistan's Supreme Court has also ruled against the Algar Karakalpakstan political party, the opposition group in Karakalpakstan, and defined it as extremist. That was in February this year, and banned its activities in Uzbekistan. And its leader is a Karakalpakstan activist, and he's based in Norway. So there's another effort by Uzbekistan to sort of really clamp down on and define as extremist, not only people living outside the country, but also, you know, political movements within the country. So it's a very cynical effort by Uzbekistan to sort of close down all channels, really.
If I may add about the Kazakh the Karakalpak activists arrested in Kazakhstan. So the two activists that were arrested there just recently, and that happened in April 2024. One activist name is Otambet Afrinat. He is 43 years old, and he was arrested in Almaty. He was charged also with Article 159, and that is encroachment on the constitutional system of the Republic of Uzbekistan. And he publicly advocated against the constitutional amendments, just like the others. And the second one, his name is Rasul Jumaniyazov, and he was arrested in Astana in March, 30th of March, also an activist from Karakalpakstan. Also arrested at the request of Uzbek authorities for his activity on social media platforms. The other five that we know a little more about are Tlyubike Yuldashova, and she's known as an activist since at least 2019, and she also suffered terrible torture at the hands of Uzbek law enforcement. She was raped, and she made a public statement about this incident. And so she continues her activism despite her traumatic experiences. The other one, she's sentenced in absentia to 8.5 years in prison. The second activist in Kazakhstan is Mirmambetova Zioar, and she is the cook I mentioned previously. She's sentenced in absentia to 8 years in prison, also for similar articles, pretty much encroachment on constitutional order, mass riots, production, storage, and distribution of materials that are a public threat somehow. And the other activist is Raisa Kudaybergianova, and she is also the cardiologist I mentioned about. She was accused basically that she has participated in a protest in a state of alcoholic inebriation and while she actually was at the time of the protest, she was at home in Kazakhstan and she was actually at work the entire day. And she was charged with the similar articles on encroachment on constitutional order. She is sentenced in absentia to 3 years. The next activist is Koshkarbayteri Muratov. He is now seeking asylum in one of the European countries, and he was sentenced to 5 years in absentia. And Tori Muratov actually spent some years in prison already in the past for his activism. The next one is Jaksambekadov Zhangildi, also sentenced to his sentence is actually one of the largest ones, and it's 10 years and 1 month. For public calls to mass riots, encroachment on constitutional order. And the last, but not the least, is the Kalbek Muratov that Hugh has described as the primary point of contact for Karakalpak diaspora overseas by the English speaking community. He was the main voice for Karakalpaks, I think, in the English speaking world.
Thank you. What can you tell us about Akobek? You certainly get word about his situation right now. He's been, as you said, he was been detained since February. How is he? What do you hear about him?
Yes. While Akobek has been in prison, he has met many other Karakalpaks who are also incarcerated. His imprisonment has been incredibly difficult for him and his family. His parents are deeply concerned about his unjust imprisonment. Additionally, he experienced the loss of his beloved uncle, a passionate Karakalpak patriot, during his time in prison, which has been emotionally challenging for him. His son, at a critical age needing paternal support, guidance, and encouragement, faces hardship due to his father's absence. Akobek is detained despite exercising his constitutional rights without committing any crime. How does one explain to a young child that the Uzbek government operates with corruption and disregard for the law? This situation has been particularly tough on his wife, who longs for his return sooner than the 12 months he has been sentenced to in Kazakhstan.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any word on any of the other activists we've been talking about?
Yes, I have been in touch with the activists mentioned here. But I also wanted to highlight that there are hundreds of others in Karakalpakstan who have been detained and subjected to torture. Specifically, I wanted to draw attention to two bloggers who endured physical torture in Uzbek prisons, Mustafa Tursunbayev and Salamat Atamuratov. They were sentenced to 5 years in prison. Medical doctors confirmed that Mustafa's ribs were broken due to torture, but the court disregarded these reports. Both bloggers are well known, with over 100,000 subscribers each on their channels. Their cases are emblematic of the brutal treatment faced by many in Karakalpakstan.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Leila, I was wondering if you could tell us, there's been a couple of bloggers detained in Uzbekistan lately that are Karakalpaks. Could you, Freedom for Eurasia has reported on them. Could you give, tell us a little bit about them, please?
So in recent months, we have seen several people, not just, bloggers also, you can call them, I guess, but just people who are trying, also along with the bloggers, there were a number of people that were trying to use social media and YouTube and Telegram channels. And it seems like there is a wave of repressions that are strengthening by the Uzbek authorities against people who are speaking up. And these bloggers that were detained, they were speaking about issues that are really not, may not really seem as a threat to authorities normally, because they were like speaking about issues of presence of Karakalpak language in their cities and towns. And one blogger was making videos about, basically labels signs around the town that they're not seeing anything in Karakalpak language around the town. And so these are, you know, very, very simple things that might not normally raise concerns with authorities. But I think the Uzbek authorities are now so actively trying to repress Karakalpaks and basically suppress them and erase them from any public spaces, that they are arresting them for seemingly very innocent publications and very, very innocent materials that they might produce. And the themes such as the topics such as, you know, Karakalpak identity or Karakalpak culture or Karakalpak language are all being now persecuted.
I think Minaim wanted to say something. Did you want to say something, Minaim?
Yes, I just wanted to point out the irony that the Uzbek government accuses Karakalpaks of disrupting the constitutional order when it's actually the Uzbek government itself that is undermining constitutional norms. Furthermore, while they label Karakalpakstan as an extremist political movement, it's the Uzbek government that exhibits extremist actions. They resort to using heavy military artillery against peaceful protests. And it's crucial that the government of Uzbekistan be held accountable for these actions.
Indeed, and that's an important point that we should sort of remember in this way, in this context, that it's really the Uzbek government we should be focusing on, and, you know, organizations like myself and perhaps other organizations as well are calling for that accountability. And the points about bloggers that Leyla was mentioning, you know, it's not just bloggers from Karakalpakstan who've been arrested recently. We've seen a wave of bloggers being arrested. We reckon there's now about at least a dozen bloggers behind bars in prison, some of them on dubious extortion charges. And this is it seems to be a sort of backlash away from the openness that President Mirziyoyev talked about a couple of years ago that he wanted in the media and elsewhere. I mean, in general, it's our view that what's happened in Karakalpakstan is also sort of symbolic of a worsening of the human rights situation in the last couple of years compared to what happened, you know, in 2016 and 17, at least on paper and in the rhetoric, when President Mirziyoyev took power, you know, after the terrible, you know, dictator Islam Karimov, and he really talked about an opening and some reforms. A large number of political prisoners were released. There was an end to systematic forced labor in the cotton fields. I remember being in Uzbekistan at that time, and there was a genuine mood of optimism, at least talking to the government and to talk to some activists and so on. And now we're really into a different phase. I think we have to remember that, and that should be the basis of our approach, that we're in a different phase, a clamping down on human rights now. It was never, you know, the reforms were very small, and now there's a clamping down again and a backwards sliding, in a sense. Many proposed laws have not been implemented, or legal changes to the criminal code have not been implemented. So we're really into a negative phase, and, you know, that's why also let's remember that Uzbekistan wants to be part of the international community. It wants to have more recognition, more international standing in Europe, with the United States, in the United Nations. It's making significant efforts to do so. So the countries with which it is engaging, you know, the United States, Europe, in UN forums, these need to really take the opportunity to raise these human rights issues with Uzbekistan. For instance, what happened 2 years ago in Karakalpakstan. So these governments and international bodies also have a responsibility to not forget what happened in Karakalpakstan and raise these more recent issues around bloggers, about freedom of speech, about You know, there's increasing numbers of cases of even people criticizing the president online in extremely harmless ways, being put in prison for doing so. These are really awful developments in Uzbekistan, and they need to be drawn to the government's attention by their international partners.
I totally agree with that point. And I also often think of how much effort Uzbekistan and money, actually, Uzbekistan is spending on its PR campaigns around the world to portray itself as this, reforming country on its way to democracy. And I think it would have really been much better and much easier for them to just simply fulfill their obligations. It's not really difficult to do. What can I say? Just stop torturing people, stop arresting people on bogus charges. Don't violate people's right to free expression and free assembly. Very simple things. When you think about it, instead of spending millions on PR campaigns and consultants to create this pink smoke, which people still see through.
Okay, thank you. We're coming toward the end. We could go talk a lot more, and we're going to have to come back to this because there's some points that I wanted to bring up, but we are running short on time. So I'm going to give everyone a chance to make last comment. You can keep it to 2 or 3 minutes. I'd appreciate it. But let me just throw out here that, it was the Uzbek government's decision to try to amend the constitution, and that started the problem. It was the Uzbek police, in their excessive use of force and irresponsible use of force, that ended up bringing all the casualties that happened out there. And yet, I think I've been watching Uzbekistan for years. You could make the argument that the plight, the situation for Karakalpaks is worse now than it ever has been since Uzbekistan became independent, even though the fault for everything that happened 2 years ago lies with the authorities. Would you agree with that statement, or am I getting it wrong? And I'll start with you, Hugh.
Absolutely, I would agree with that statement. I've been to Nukus a couple of times. It's a very, on the one hand, the people are obviously courageous, strong people. The human rights activists I've engaged with there are, as I said, courageous people. But they're, this was before the crackdown and the killings. But it's in a much worse situation than before. An atmosphere of fear is what we gather from the contacts we still have there. The government needs to act on that. It needs to both we have not talked about the sort of socioeconomic aspects of this, that it's a poor region that needs economic development. It doesn't need repression. It needs development. It needs money to help develop the economy and the local, enable people to have jobs and livelihoods and so on. But also there needs to be some accountability. I'll go back to that point. For what happened, the commission not only needs to deliver its report, but there needs to be an independent investigation. Great if the Uzbek government's part of it, but it needs to be credible with international experts deciding what's happened. So you're right, Bruce. Karakalpakstan is in a worse situation than before, and it's the government's fault for that.
Leila?
I agree with you that the situation of Karakalpaks has worsened. But what we also are seeing now is more coverage of the region and more information available in the international sources about the situation in Karakalpakstan, unlike several years ago when we had very little information about this republic. What I also think is it is important for Uzbek authorities to actually start thinking about allowing Karakalpak Republic and people of Karakalpakstan to have political representation of their own in their own republic, and allow them to participate in the management and running of their republic because this is something that they've been demanding for decades. I also noticed that there is a raised sense of Karakalpak identity, and I think it's going to only increase with the years. I mean, what I'm trying to say is Uzbek authorities are not going to be successful in suppressing that. Whatever actions the Uzbek authorities will be taking in the future to, you know, repression, to just to suppress the people of Karakalpakstan is going to lead to a totally opposite result. So, there is a lot for Uzbek authorities to think about. And I hope maybe we will have a chance to speak with them again in October at the ODIHR conference, hopefully. And I hope they will be ready for a constructive dialogue with us.
Okay, thank you. Miriam, it's your homeland, so you get the last word. What would you like to say?
I wanted to bring attention to a critical issue that has long been overlooked: the right of Karakalpakstan to self-determination. Karakalpakstan has a robust legal foundation for this right, having declared its independence from the USSR before Uzbekistan did. Furthermore, in 1993, Karakalpakstan signed a temporary 20-year agreement with Uzbekistan, establishing itself as a sovereign republic with the right to secede. It boasts its own constitution and parliament. Yet, despite these clear legal grounds, Western countries remain hesitant to address the rights of Karakalpakstan, prioritizing the territorial integrity of Uzbekistan over the self-determination of the Karakalpak people. This is a misguided approach. Karakalpakstan meets all legal criteria for independence, and self-determination should take precedence over territorial integrity. I urge the embassies of democratic nations in Uzbekistan to adopt an inclusive stance, ensure that official communication is conducted in both Uzbek and Karakalpak languages, given that Karakalpakstan comprises 40% of Uzbekistan's territory. Recognizing Karakalpak as an official language is both practical and essential for preserving a language currently under threat from the Uzbek government. Karakalpakstan occupies a significant geopolitical location with close proximity to Afghanistan and within the interest of China and Russia. It is surrounded by authoritarian regimes like Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Turkmenistan. The USSR's largest chemical weapon testing center was located in Karakalpakstan, making it an epicenter of ecological disaster. However, it is also a place of immense potential. Rich in natural resources, Karakalpakstan could become a hub for innovations and alternative energy solutions, given its extreme summer temperatures and strong winds. Western policy towards Central Asia has been weak, with a reluctance to hold Uzbekistan accountable for grave human rights violations due to fears of pushing it closer to Russia. In the past, the U.S. had consistently promoted economic and cultural exchanges with oppressed minorities, leading to numerous success stories where those territories became democratic and economically developed after U.S. intervention. However, current U.S. policies are disappointing. While there is much talk about race equity and inclusion, the reality is starkly different. USAID administrator recently traveled to Uzbekistan but did not visit Karakalpakstan, the poorest region of Uzbekistan, plagued by economic, environmental, and health issues, with an average life expectancy of just 55 years and high infant mortality rates. USAID could have made tangible efforts to alleviate some of these issues, yet they did not. Last month, the Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy and Human Rights visited Uzbekistan but failed to raise human rights issues with the Uzbek government. This inaction is a significant departure from the U.S. historical commitment to supporting oppressed minorities. Western Europe, with its history of colonialism and the Holocaust, has an opportunity to write a better history in this century by aiding the oppressed Karakalpak people, whose culture and language are being systematically destroyed by the Uzbek government. On the second anniversary of the bloody massacre in Karakalpakstan, we remember those who lost their lives and thank everyone who participated in the peaceful protests to preserve Karakalpakstan's sovereignty. Without their courage, nothing would be left of Karakalpakstan. As it written, we are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed, perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down, but not destroyed. We do not lose heart. Karakalpak people need advocacy, as many have been silenced by the Uzbek government. I believe that light can overcome darkness, and I encourage everyone to stand up for the Karakalpak people. Many thanks to Bruce Penner, Freedom of Eurasia, and Human Rights Watch for covering the issues in Karakalpakstan. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was a powerful ending, Minem, just to say that. Thank you so much for saying that.
Thank you. Thank you to Minaim, Lila, and Hugh. And a big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Medley's podcast in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Medley's podcast or the Central Asian Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfrl.org. Thanks, and we'll be back again soon. Bye-bye.